Then she lifted the blanket and let her finger bleed on the sheets where they had lain together. Mariam. In the daytime, the girl was no more than a creaking bedspring, a patter of footsteps overhead. She was water splashing in the bathroom, or a teaspoon clinking against glass in the bedroom upstairs. Occasionally, there were sightings, a blur of billowing dress in the periphery of Mariam's vision, scurrying up the steps, arms folded across the chest, sandals slapping the heels. But it was inevitable that they would run into each other. Mariam passed the girl on the stairs, in the narrow hallway, in the kitchen, or by the door as she was coming in from the yard. When they met like this, an awkward tension rushed into the space between them. The girl gathered her skirt and breathed out a word or two of apology, and, as she hurried past, Mariam would chance a sidelong glance and catch a blush. Sometimes she could smell Rashid on her. She could smell his sweat on the girl's skin, his tobacco, his appetite. Sex, mercifully, was a closed chapter in her own life. It had been for some time, and now even the thought of those laborious sessions of lying beneath Rashid made Mariam queasy in the gut. At night, however, this mutually orchestrated dance of avoidance between her and the girl was not possible. Rashid said they were a family. He insisted they were, and families had to eat together, he said. "What is this?" he said, his fingers working the meat off a bone. The spoon and fork charade was abandoned a week after he married the girl. "Have I married a pair of statues? Go on, Mariam, gampezan. Say something to her. Where are your manners?" "Sucking marrow from a bone," he said to the girl. "But you mustn't blame her. She's quiet. A blessing, really, because, wallah, if a person hasn't got much to say, she might as well be stingy with words. We are city people, you and I, but she is, Deati, a village girl. Not even a village girl, no. She grew up in a koiba made of mud, outside the village. Her father put her there. Have you told her, Mariam? Have you told her that you are a harami? Well, she is. But she's not without qualities, all things considered. You will see for yourself, Laila John. She's sturdy, for one thing, a good worker, and without pretensions. I'll say it this way. If she were a car, she would be a Volga." Mariam was a 33-year-old woman now. But that word, harami, still had sting. Hearing it still made her feel like she was a pest, a cockroach. She remembered Nana pulling her wrists. "You're clumsy, little harami. This is my reward for everything I've endured. An heirloom-breaking, clumsy little harami." "You," Rashid said to the girl, "you, on the other hand, would be a Benz, a brand-new, first-class, shiny Benz. Wah, wah. But, but." He raised one greasy index finger. "One must take certain cares with a Benz. As a matter of respect for its beauty and craftsmanship, you see. Oh, you must be thinking that I'm crazy, Dewana, with all this talk of automobiles. I'm not saying you're cars. I'm merely making a point." For what came next, Rashid put down the ball of rice he'd made back on the plate. His hands dangled idly over his meal as he looked down with a sober, thoughtful expression. "One mustn't speak ill of the dead, much less the Shahid. And I intend no disrespect when I say this, I want you to know. But I have certain reservations about the way your parents, Allah forgive them and grant them a place in paradise, about their, well, their leniency with you. I'm sorry." The cold, hateful look the girl flashed Rashid at this did not escape Mariam. But he was looking down and did not notice. "No matter. The point is, I am your husband now, and it falls on me to guard not only your honor, but ours, yes, our nang and namus. That is the husband's burden. You let me worry about that, please. As for you, you're the queen, the malika, and this house is your palace. Anything you need done, you ask Mariam, and she will do it for you. Won't you, Mariam? And if you fancy something, I will get it for you. You see? That is the sort of husband I am." All I ask in return, well, it is a simple thing. I ask that you avoid leaving this house without my company. That's all. Simple, no? If I am away and you need something urgently, I mean absolutely need it, and it cannot wait for me, then you can send Mariam and she will go out and get it for you. You've noticed a discrepancy, surely. Well, one does not drive a Volga and a Benz in the same manner. That would be foolish, wouldn't it? Oh, I also ask that when we're out together, that you wear a burqa, for your own protection, naturally. It is best. So many lewd men in this town now. Such vile intentions, so eager to dishonor even a married woman. So, that's all. He coughed. I should say that Mariam will be my eyes and ears when I'm away. Here, he shot Mariam a fleeting look that was as hard as a steel toad kicked to the temple. Not that I'm mistrusting. Quite the contrary. Frankly, you strike me as far wiser than your years. But you're still a young woman, Laila Jan, a Dukhtar-e Jawan. And young women can make unfortunate choices. They can be prone to mischief. Anyway, Mariam will be accountable. And if there's a slip-up... On and on he went. Mariam sat watching the girl out of the corner of her eye as Rashid's demands and judgments rained down on them like the rockets on Kabul. One day, Mariam was in the living room folding some shirts of Rashid's that she had plucked from the clothesline in the yard. She didn't know how long the girl had been standing there, but when she picked up a shirt and turned around, she found her standing by the doorway, hands cupped around a glass full of tea. I didn't mean to startle you, the girl said. I'm sorry. Mariam only looked at her. The sun fell on the girl's face, on her large green eyes and her smooth brow, on her high cheekbones and the appealing, thick eyebrows, which were nothing like Mariam's own, thin and featureless. Her yellow hair, uncombed this morning, was middle parted. Mariam could see in the stiff way the girl clutched the cup, the tightened shoulders, that she was nervous. She imagined her sitting on the bed, working up the nerve. The leaves are turning, the girl said companionably. Have you seen? Autumn is my favorite. I like the smell of it, when people burn leaves in their gardens. My mother, she liked springtime the best. You knew my mother?
Not really.
The girl cupped a hand behind her ear. I'm sorry? Mariam raised her voice.
I said no, I didn't know your mother.
Oh.
Is there something you want?
Mariam Jan, I want to... About the things he said the other night.
I've been meaning to talk to you about it, Mariam broke in.
Yes, please, the girl said earnestly, almost eagerly.
She took a step forward. She looked relieved. Outside, an oriole was warbling. Someone was pulling a cart. Mariam could hear the creaking of its hinges, the bouncing and rattling of its iron wheels. There was the sound of gunfire, not so far away. A single shot followed by three more, then nothing.
I won't be your servant, Mariam said. I won't.
The girl flinched.
No, of course not.
You may be the palace Malika and Mia Deoti, but I won't take orders from you. You can complain to him, and he can slit my throat, but I won't do it. Do you hear me? I won't be your servant.
No, I don't expect...
And if you think you can use your looks to get rid of me, you're wrong. I was here first. I won't be thrown out. I won't have you cast me out.
It's not what I want, the girl said weakly.
And I see your wounds are healed up now, so you can start doing your share of the work in this house.
The girl was nodding quickly. Some of her tea spilled, but she didn't notice. Yes, that's the other reason I came down, to thank you for taking care of me.
Well, I wouldn't have, Mariam snapped. I wouldn't have fed you and washed you and nursed you if I'd known you were going to turn around and steal my husband.
Steal?
I will still cook and wash the dishes. You will do the laundry and the sweeping. The rest we will alternate daily. And one more thing. I have no use for your company. I don't want it. What I want is to be alone. You will leave me be, and I will return the favor. That's how we will get on. Those are the rules. When she was done speaking, her heart was hammering and her mouth felt parched. Mariam had never before spoken in this manner, had never stated her will so forcefully. It ought to have felt exhilarating, but the girl's eyes had teared up and her face was drooping. And what satisfaction Mariam found from this outburst felt meager, somehow illicit. She extended the shirts toward the girl. Put them in the almori, not the closet. He likes the whites in the top drawer, the rest in the middle with the socks. The girl set the cup on the floor and put her hands out for the shirts, palm up. I'm sorry about all this, she croaked.
You should be, Mariam said. You should be sorry.
Layla. Layla remembered a gathering once, years before at the house, on one of Mummy's good days. The women had been sitting in the garden, eating from a platter of fresh mulberries that Wajma had picked from the tree in her yard. The plump mulberries had been white and pink, and some the same dark purple as the bursts of tiny veins on Wajma's nose.
You heard how his son died?
Wajma had said, energetically shoveling another handful of mulberries into her sunken mouth.
He drowned, didn't he? Nila, Giti's mother, said, at Qarra Lake, wasn't it? But did you know that Rashid?
Wajma raised a finger, made a show of nodding and chewing, and making them wait for her to swallow.
Did you know that he used to drink sharab back then? That he was crying drunk that day?
It's true. Crying drunk is what I heard. And that was mid-morning. By noon, he had passed out on a lounge chair. You could have fired the noon cannon next to his ear, and he wouldn't have batted an eyelash. Layla remembered how Wajma had covered her mouth, burped, how her tongue had gone exploring between her few remaining teeth. You can imagine the rest. The boy went into the water unnoticed. They spotted him a while later, floating face down. People rushed to help, half trying to wake up the boy, the other half, the father. Someone bent over the boy, did the mouth-to-mouth thing you're supposed to do. It was pointless. They could all see that. The boy was gone. Layla remembered Wajma raising a finger and her voice quivering with piety. This is why the Holy Quran forbids sharab, because it always falls on the sober to pay for the sins of the drunk. So it does. It was this story that was circling in Layla's head after she gave Rashid the news about the baby. He had immediately hopped on his bicycle, ridden to a mosque, and prayed for a boy. That night, all during the meal, Layla watched Mariam push a cube of meat around her plate. Layla was there when Rashid sprang the news on Mariam in a high, dramatic voice. Layla had never before witnessed such cheerful cruelty. Mariam's lashes fluttered when she heard. A flush spread across her face. She sat sulking, looking desolate. After, Rashid went upstairs to listen to his radio, and Layla helped Mariam clear the sofra.
I can't imagine what you're now, Mariam said, picking grains of rice and breadcrumbs. If you were a Benz before.
Layla tried a more lighthearted tactic. A train? Maybe a big jumbo jet? Mariam straightened up.
I hope you don't think this excuses you from chores.
Layla opened her mouth, thought better of it. She reminded herself that Mariam was the only innocent party in this arrangement. Mariam and the baby. Later, in bed, Layla burst into tears. What was the matter? Rashid wanted to know, lifting her chin. Was she ill? Was it the baby? Was something wrong with the baby? No? Was Mariam mistreating her?
That's it, isn't it?
No.
Wallah billah, I'll go down and teach her a lesson. Who does she think she is, that Arami, treating you?
No. He was getting up already, and she had to grab him by the forearm, pull him back down.
Don't! No! She's been decent to me. I need a minute, that's all. I'll be fine.
He sat beside her, stroking her neck, murmuring. His hand slowly crept down to her back, then up again. He leaned in, flashed his crowded teeth.
Let's see then, he purred, if I can't help you feel better.
First the trees, those that hadn't been cut down for firewood, shed their spotty, yellow and copper leaves. Then came the winds, cold and raw, ripping through the city. They tore off the last of the clinging leaves and left the trees looking ghostly against the muted brown of the hills. The season's first snowfall was light, the flakes no sooner fallen than melted. Then the roads froze, and snow gathered in heaps on the rooftops, piled halfway up frost-caked windows. With snow came the kites, once the rulers of Kabul's winter skies, now timid trespassers in territory claimed by streaking rockets and fighter jets. Rashid kept bringing home news of the war, and Laila was baffled by the allegiances that Rashid tried to explain to her. Sayyaf was fighting the Hazaras, he said. The Hazaras were fighting Masood. And he's fighting Hikmatyar, of course, who has the support of the Pakistanis. Mortal enemies, those two, Masood and Hikmatyar. Sayyaf, he's siding with Masood. And Hikmatyar supports the Hazaras for now. As for the unpredictable Uzbek commander Dostum, Rashid said no one knew where he would stand. Dostum had fought the Soviets in the 1980s alongside the Mujahideen, but had defected and joined Najibullah's communist puppet regime after the Soviets had left. He had even earned a medal, presented by Najibullah himself, before defecting once again and returning to the Mujahideen's side. For the time being, Rashid said, Dostum was supporting Masood. In Kabul, particularly in western Kabul, fires raged and black palls of smoke mushroomed over snow-clad buildings. Embassies closed down, schools collapsed. In hospital waiting rooms, Rashid said, the wounded were bleeding to death. In operating rooms, limbs were being amputated without anesthesia. But don't worry, he said. You're safe with me, my flower, my gol. Anyone tries to harm you, I'll rip out their liver and make them eat it. That winter, everywhere Laila turned, walls blocked her way. She thought longingly of the wide-open skies of her childhood, of her days of going to Bozkashi tournaments with Bobby and shopping at Mandai with Mami, of her days of running free in the streets and gossiping about boys with Giti and Hasina. Her days of sitting with Tariq in the bed of clover on the banks of a stream somewhere, trading riddles and candy, watching the sun go down. But thinking of Tariq was treacherous because, before she could stop, she saw him lying on a bed, far from home, tubes piercing his burned body. Like the bile that kept burning her throat these days, a deep, paralyzing grief would come rising up Laila's chest. Her legs would turn to water. She would have to hold on to something. Laila passed that winter of 1992, sweeping the house, scrubbing the pumpkin-colored walls of the bedroom she shared with Rashid, washing clothes outside in a big copper lagan. Sometimes she saw herself as if hovering above her own body, saw herself squatting over the rim of the lagan. Sleeves rolled up to the elbows, pink hands wringing soapy water from one of Rashid's undershirts. She felt lost then, casting about like a shipwreck survivor, no shore in sight, only miles and miles of water. When it was too cold to go outside, Laila ambled around the house. She walked, dragging a fingernail along the wall, down the hallway, then back, down the steps, then up, her face unwashed, hair uncombed. She walked until she ran into Mariam, who shot her a cheerless glance and went back to slicing the stem off a bell pepper and trimming strips of fat from meat. A hurtful silence would fill the room, and Laila could almost see the wordless hostility radiating from Mariam like waves of heat rising from asphalt. She would retreat back to her room, sit on the bed, and watch the snow falling. Rashid took her to his shoe shop one day. When they were out together, he walked alongside her, one hand gripping her by the elbow. For Layla, being out in the streets had become an exercise in avoiding injury. Her eyes were still adjusting to the limited, grid-like visibility of the burqa, her feet still stumbling over the hem. She walked in perpetual fear of tripping and falling, of breaking an ankle, stepping into a pothole. Still, she found some comfort in the anonymity that the burqa provided. She wouldn't be recognized this way if she ran into an old acquaintance of hers. She wouldn't have to watch the surprise in their eyes, or the pity, or the glee, at how far she had fallen, at how her lofty aspirations had been dashed. Rashid's shop was bigger and more brightly lit than Layla had imagined. He had her sit behind his crowded workbench, the top of which was littered with old soles and scraps of leftover leather. He showed her his hammers, demonstrated how the sandpaper wheel worked, his voice ringing high and proud. He felt her belly, not through the shirt, but under it, his fingertips cold and rough like bark on her distended skin. Layla remembered Tariq's hands, soft but strong, the tortuous, full veins on the backs of them, which she had always found so appealingly masculine.
"Swelling so quickly," Rashid said. "It's going to be a big boy. My son will be a Palawan, like his father."
Layla pulled down her shirt. It filled her with fear when he spoke like this.
"How are things with Mariam?"
"She said they were fine."
"Good, good."
She didn't tell him that they'd had their first true fight. It had happened a few days earlier. Layla had gone to the kitchen and found Mariam yanking drawers and slamming them shut. She was looking, Mariam said, for the long wooden spoon she used to stir rice.
"Where did you put it?" she said, wheeling around to face Layla.
"Me?" Layla said. "I didn't take it. I hardly come in here."
"I've noticed."
"Is that an accusation? It's how you wanted it, remember? You said you would make the meals, but if you want to switch..."
"So you're saying it grew little legs and walked out, teep, 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 teep? Is that what happened, Diga?"
"I'm saying," Layla said, trying to maintain control. Usually, she could will herself to absorb Mariam's derision and finger-pointing. But her ankles had swollen, her head hurt, and the heartburn was vicious that day.
"I'm saying that maybe you've misplaced it."
"Misplaced it?"
Mariam pulled a drawer. The spatulas and knives inside it clanked.
"How long have you been here? A few months? I've lived in this house for 19 years, Dr. Joe. I've kept that spoon in this drawer since you were shitting your diapers."
"Still," Layla said, on the brink now, teeth clenched. "It's possible you put it somewhere and forgot."
"And it's possible you hid it somewhere to aggravate me."
"You're a sad, miserable woman," Layla said.
Mariam flinched, then recovered, pursed her lips.
"And you're a whore. A whore and a doz. A thieving whore, that's what you are."
Then there was shouting, pots raised, though not hurled. They'd called each other names, names that made Layla blush now. They hadn't spoken since. Layla was still shocked at how easily she'd come unhinged, but the truth was, part of her had liked it, had liked how it felt to scream at Mariam, to curse at her, to have a target at which to focus all her simmering anger, her grief. Layla wondered, with something like insight, if it wasn't the same for Mariam. After, she had run upstairs and thrown herself on Rashid's bed. Downstairs, Mariam was still yelling,
"Dirt on your head! Dirt on your head!"
Layla had lain on the bed, groaning into the pillow, missing her parents suddenly, and with an overpowering intensity she hadn't felt since those terrible days just after the attack. She lay there, clutching handfuls of the bedsheet, until suddenly her breath caught. She sat up, hands shooting down to her belly. The baby had just kicked for the first time. Mariam. Early one morning the next spring of 1993, Mariam stood by the living room window and watched Rashid escort the girl out of the house. The girl was tottering forward, bent at the waist, one arm draped protectively across the taut drum of her belly, the shape of which was visible through her burqa. Rashid, anxious and overly attentive, was holding her elbow, directing her across the yard like a traffic policeman. He made a "wait here" gesture, rushed to the front gate, then motioned for the girl to come forward, one foot propping the gate open. When she reached him, he took her by the hand, helped her through the gate. Mariam could almost hear him say, "Watch your step now, my flower, my gol." They came back early the next evening. Mariam saw Rashid enter the yard first. He let the gate go prematurely, and it almost hit the girl in the face. He crossed the yard in a few quick steps. Mariam detected a shadow on his face, a darkness underlying the coppery light of dusk. In the house, he took off his coat, threw it on the couch. Brushing past Mariam, he said in a brusque voice, "I'm hungry. Get supper ready." The front door to the house opened. From the hallway, Mariam saw the girl, a swaddled bundle in the hook of her left arm. She had one foot outside, the other inside, against the door, to prevent it from springing shut. She was stooped over and was grunting, trying to reach for the paper bag of belongings that she had put down in order to open the door. Her face was grimacing with effort. She looked up and saw Mariam. Mariam turned around and went to the kitchen to warm Rashid's meal.
"It's like someone is ramming a screwdriver into my ear," Rashid said, rubbing his eyes.
He was standing in Mariam's door, puffy-eyed, wearing only a tombon tied with a floppy knot. His white hair was straggly, pointing every which way.
"This crying, I can't stand it."
Downstairs, the girl was walking the baby across the floor, trying to sing to her.
"I haven't had a decent night's sleep in 2 months," Rashid said. "And the room smells like a sewer. There's shit cloths lying all over the place. I stepped on one just the other night."
Mariam smirked inwardly, with perverse pleasure.
"Take her outside," Rashid yelled over his shoulder. "Can't you take her outside?"
The singing was suspended briefly.
"She'll catch pneumonia."
"It's summertime."
"What?"
Rashid clenched his teeth and raised his voice.
"I said it's warm out."
"I'm not taking her outside."
The singing resumed.
"Sometimes I swear, sometimes I want to put that thing in a box and let her float down Kabul River like baby Moses."
Mariam never heard him call his daughter by the name the girl had given her, Aziza, the cherished one. It was always the baby, or, when he was really exasperated, that thing. Some nights, Mariam overheard them arguing. She tiptoed to their door, listening to him complain about the baby, always the baby, the instant crying, the smells, the toys that made him trip, the way the baby had hijacked Laila's attentions from him with constant demands to be fed, burped, changed, walked, held. The girl, in turn, scolded him for smoking in the room, for not letting the baby sleep with them. There were other arguments waged in voices pitched low.
"The doctor said 6 weeks."
"Not yet, Rashid. No, let go. Come on, don't do that. It's been 2 months. Shh, there, you woke up the baby."
Then, more sharply,
"Khoshidi, happy now?"
Mariam would sneak back to her room.
"Can't you help?" Rashid said now. "There must be something you can do."
"What do I know about babies?" Mariam said.
"Rashid, can you bring the bottle? It's sitting on the almari. She won't feed. I want to try the bottle again."
The baby's screeching rose and fell like a cleaver on meat. Rashid closed his eyes.
That thing is a warlord. Hekmatyar. I'm telling you, Layla's given birth to Golbuddin Hekmatyar.
Mariam watched as the girl's days became consumed with cycles of feeding, rocking, bouncing, walking. Even when the baby napped, there were soiled diapers to scrub and leave to soak in a pail of disinfectant that the girl had insisted Rashid buy for her. There were fingernails to trim with sandpaper, coveralls and pajamas to wash and hang to dry. These clothes, like other things about the baby, became a point of contention.
"What's the matter with them?" Rashid said.
"They're boys' clothes, for a bacha."
"You think she knows the difference? I pay good money for those clothes. And another thing, I don't care for that tone. Consider that a warning."
Every week, without fail, the girl heated a black metal brazier over a flame, tossed a pinch of wild rue seeds in it, and wafted the espandi smoke in her baby's direction to ward off evil. Mariam found it exhausting to watch the girl's lolloping enthusiasm and had to admit, if only privately, to a degree of admiration. She marveled at how the girl's eyes shone with worship, even in the mornings when her face drooped and her complexion was waxy from a night's worth of walking the baby. The girl had fits of laughter when the baby passed gas. The tiniest changes in the baby enchanted her, and everything it did was declared spectacular.
"Look, she's reaching for the rattle. How clever she is."
"I'll call the newspapers," said Rashid.
Every night there were demonstrations. When the girl insisted he witness something, Rashid tipped his chin upward and cast an impatient, sidelong glance down the blue-veined hook of his nose.
"Watch! Watch how she laughs when I snap my fingers. There, see? Did you see?"
Rashid would grunt and go back to his plate. Mariam remembered how the girl's mere presence used to overwhelm him. Everything she said used to please him, intrigue him, make him look up from his plate and nod with approval. The strange thing was, the girl's fall from grace ought to have pleased Mariam, brought her a sense of vindication. But it didn't. It didn't. To her own surprise, Mariam found herself pitying the girl. It was also over dinner that the girl let loose a steady stream of worries. Topping the list was pneumonia, which was suspected with every minor cough. Then there was dysentery, the specter of which was raised with every loose stool. Every rash was either chickenpox or measles.
"You should not get so attached," Rashid said one night.
"What do you mean?"
"I was listening to the radio the other night, Voice of America. I heard an interesting statistic. They said that in Afghanistan, 1 out of 4 children will die before the age of 5. That's what they said. Now they..." "What? What? Where are you going? Come back here. Get back here this instant."
He gave Mariam a bewildered look.
"What's the matter with her?"
That night, Mariam was lying in bed when the bickering started again. It was a hot, dry summer night, typical of the month of Saraton in Kabul. Mariam had opened her window, then shut it when no breeze came through to temper the heat, only mosquitoes. She could feel the heat rising from the ground outside, through the wheat-brown, splintered planks of the outhouse and the yard, up through the walls and into her room. Usually, the bickering ran its course after a few minutes, but half an hour had passed, and not only was it still going on, it was escalating. Mariam could hear Rashid shouting now. The girl's voice underneath his was tentative and shrill. Soon, the baby was wailing. Then Mariam heard their door open violently. In the morning, she would find the doorknob's circular impression in the hallway wall. She was sitting up in bed when her own door slammed open and Rashid came through. He was wearing white underpants and a matching undershirt, stained yellow in the underarms with sweat. On his feet, he wore flip-flops. He held a belt in his hand, the brown leather one he'd bought for his nikah with the girl, and was wrapping the perforated end around his fist.
"It's your doing. I know it is," he snarled, advancing on her.
Mariam slid out of her bed and began backpedaling, her arms instinctively crossed over her chest, where he often struck her first.
"What are you talking about?" she stammered. "Her denying me. You're teaching her to."
Over the years, Mariam had learned to harden herself against his scorn and reproach, his ridiculing and reprimanding. But this fear she had no control over. All these years, and still she shivered with fright when he was like this, sneering, tightening the belt around his fist, the creaking of the leather, the glint in his bloodshot eyes. It was the fear of the goat, released in the tiger's cage, when the tiger first looks up from its paws, begins to growl. Now the girl was in the room, her eyes wide, her face contorted.
"I should have known that you'd corrupt her," Rashid spat at Mariam.
He swung the belt, testing it against his own thigh. The buckle jingled loudly.
"Stop it! Bas!" the girl said. "Rashid, you can't do this!"
"Go back to the room!"
Mariam backpedaled again.
"No! Don't do this!"
"Now!"
Rashid raised the belt again, and this time came at Mariam. Then, an astonishing thing happened. The girl lunged at him. She grabbed his arm with both hands and tried to drag him down, but she could do no more than dangle from it. She did succeed in slowing Rashid's progress toward Mariam.
"Let go!" Rashid cried.
"You win! You win! Don't do this! Please, Rashid, no beating! Please don't do this!"
They struggled like this, the girl hanging on, pleading, Rashid trying to shake her off, keeping his eyes on Mariam, who was too stunned to do anything. In the end, Mariam knew that there would be no beating, not that night. He'd made his point. He stayed that way a few moments longer, arm raised, chest heaving, a fine sheen of sweat, filming his brow. Slowly, Rashid lowered his arm. The girl's feet touched ground, and still she wouldn't let go, as if she didn't trust him. He had to yank his arm free of her grip.
"I'm on to you," he said, slinging the belt over his shoulder. "I'm on to you both. I won't be made an ahmak, a fool in my own house."
He threw Mariam one last murderous stare and gave the girl a shove in the back on the way out. When she heard their door close, Mariam climbed back into bed, buried her head beneath the pillow, and waited for the shaking to stop. 3 times that night, Mariam was awakened from sleep. The first time, it was the rumble of rockets in the west, coming from the direction of Kartechar. The second time, it was the baby crying downstairs, the girls shushing, the clatter of spoon against milk bottle. Finally, it was thirst that pulled her out of bed. Downstairs, the living room was dark, save for a bar of moonlight spilling through the window. Mariam could hear the buzzing of a fly somewhere, could make out the outline of the cast iron stove in the corner, its pipe jutting up, then making a sharp angle just below the ceiling. On her way to the kitchen, Mariam nearly tripped over something. There was a shape at her feet. When her eyes adjusted, she made out the girl and her baby lying on the floor on top of a quilt. The girl was sleeping on her side, snoring. The baby was awake. Mariam lit the kerosene lamp on the table and hunkered down. In the light, she had her first real close-up look at the baby. The tuft of dark hair, the thick-lashed hazel eyes, the pink cheeks, and lips the color of ripe pomegranate. Mariam had the impression that the baby, too, was examining her. She was lying on her back, her head tilted sideways, looking at Mariam intently with a mixture of amusement, confusion, and suspicion. Mariam wondered if her face might frighten her, but then the baby squealed happily, and Mariam knew that a favorable judgment had been passed on her behalf.
"Shh," Mariam whispered. "You'll wake up your mother, half deaf as she is."
The baby's hand balled into a fist. It rose, fell, found a spastic path to her mouth. Around a mouthful of her own hand, the baby gave Mariam a grin, little bubbles of spittle shining on her lips. "Look at you. What a sorry sight you are, dressed like a damn boy. And all bundled up in this heat. No wonder you're still awake." Mariam pulled the blanket off the baby, was horrified to find a second one beneath, clucked her tongue, and pulled that one off too. The baby giggled with relief. She flapped her arms like a bird. "Better, nay?" As Mariam was pulling back, the baby grabbed her pinky. The tiny fingers curled themselves tightly around it. They felt warm and soft, moist with drool.
"Guna,"
the baby said. "All right, Bas, let go." The baby hung on, kicked her legs again. Mariam pulled her finger free. The baby smiled and made a series of gurgling sounds. The knuckles went back to the mouth. "What are you so happy about, huh? What are you smiling at? You're not so clever as your mother says. You have a brute for a father and a fool for a mother. You wouldn't smile so much if you knew. No, you wouldn't. Go to sleep now. Go on." Mariam rose to her feet and walked a few steps before the baby started making the eh, eh, eh sounds that Mariam knew signaled the onset of a hearty cry. She retraced her steps. "What is it? What do you want from me?" The baby grinned toothlessly. Mariam sighed. She sat down and let her finger be grabbed, looked on as the baby squeaked, as she flexed her plump legs at the hips and kicked air. Mariam sat there, watching, until the baby stopped moving and began snoring softly. Outside, mockingbirds were singing blithely, and once in a while, when the songsters took flight, Mariam could see their wings catching the phosphorescent blue of moonlight beaming through the clouds. And though her throat was parched with thirst and her feet burned with pins and needles, it was a long time before Mariam gently freed her finger from the baby's grip and got up. Layla. Of all earthly pleasures, Layla's favorite was lying next to Aziza, her baby's face so close that she could watch her big pupils dilate and shrink. Layla loved running her fingers over Aziza's pleasing, soft skin, over the dimpled knuckles, the folds of fat at her elbows. Sometimes she lay Aziza down on her chest and whispered into the soft crown of her head things about Tariq, the father who would always be a stranger to Aziza, whose face Aziza would never know. Layla told her of his aptitude for solving riddles, his trickery and mischief, his easy laugh. "He had the prettiest lashes, thick like yours, a good chin, a fine nose, and a round forehead." "Oh, your father was handsome, Aziza. He was perfect, perfect like you are." But she was careful never to mention him by name. Sometimes she caught Rashid looking at Aziza in the most peculiar way. The other night, sitting on the bedroom floor, where he was shaving a corn from his foot, he said quite casually, "So what was it like between you two?" Layla had given him a puzzled look, as though she didn't understand. "Layli and Majnun, you and the Yaklinga, the cripple. What was it you had, he and you?" "He was my friend," she said, careful that her voice not shift too much in key. She busied herself making a bottle. "You know that." "I don't know what I know." Rashid deposited the shavings on the windowsill and dropped onto the bed. The springs protested with a loud creak. He splayed his legs, picked at his crotch. "And as friends, did the two of you ever do anything out of order?"
"Out of order?"
Rashid smiled lightheartedly, but Layla could feel his gaze cold and watchful. "Let me see now. Well, did he ever give you a kiss? Maybe put his hand where it didn't belong?" Layla winced with, she hoped, an indignant air. She could feel her heart drumming in her throat.
"He was like a brother to me."
"So he was a friend or a brother?"
"Both.
Which was it?"
"He was like both."
But brothers and sisters are creatures of curiosity, yes? Sometimes a brother lets his sister see his pecker, and a sister will...
You sicken me, Lila said.
So there was nothing?
I don't want to talk about this anymore.
Rashid tilted his head, pursed his lips, nodded.
People gossiped, you know, I remember. They said all sorts of things about you two. But you're saying there was nothing.
She willed herself to glare at him. He held her eyes for an excruciatingly long time in an unblinking way that made her knuckles go pale around the milk bottle, and it took all that Lila could muster to not falter. She shuddered at what he would do if he found out that she had been stealing from him. Every week since Aziza's birth, she pried his wallet open when he was asleep or in the outhouse and took a single bill. Some weeks, if the wallet was light, she took only a 5 Afghani bill or nothing at all for fear that he would notice. When the wallet was plump, she helped herself to a 10 or a 20, once even risking 2 20s. She hid the money in a pouch she'd sewn in the lining of her checkered winter coat. She wondered what he would do if he knew that she was planning to run away next spring, next summer at the latest. Lila hoped to have 1,000 Afghanis or more stowed away, half of which would go to the bus fare from Kabul to Peshawar. She would pawn her wedding ring when the time drew close, as well as the other jewelry that Rashid had given her the year before when she was still the Malika of his palace. Anyway, he said at last, fingers drumming his belly, I can't be blamed. I'm a husband. There are things a husband wonders. But he's lucky he died the way he did. Because if he was here now, if I got my hands on him... He sucked through his teeth and shook his head.
What happened to not speaking ill of the dead?
I guess some people can't be dead enough, he said.
2 days later, Lila woke up in the morning and found a stack of baby clothes neatly folded outside her bedroom door. There was a twirl dress with little pink fishes sewn around the bodice, a blue floral wool dress with matching socks and mittens, yellow pajamas with carrot-colored polka dots, and green cotton pants with a dotted ruffle on the cuff.
There's a rumor, Rashid said over dinner that night, smacking his lips, taking no notice of Aziza or the pajamas Lila had put on her, that Dostum is going to change sides and join Hekmatyar. Masood will have his hands full then, fighting those two. And we mustn't forget the Hazaras.
He took a pinch of the pickled eggplant Mariam had made that summer.
Let's hope it's just that, a rumor. Because if that happens, this war, he waved one greasy hand, will seem like a Friday picnic at Parman.
Later, he mounted her and relieved himself with wordless haste, fully dressed, save for his tomban, not removed, but pulled down to the ankles. When the frantic rocking was over, he rolled off her and was asleep in minutes. Lila slipped out of the bedroom and found Mariam in the kitchen squatting, cleaning a pair of trout. A pot of rice was already soaking beside her. The kitchen smelled like cumin and smoke, browned onions and fish. Lila sat in a corner and draped her knees with the hem of her dress.
Thank you, she said.
Mariam took no notice of her. She finished cutting up the first trout and picked up the second. With a serrated knife, she clipped the fins, then turned the fish over, its underbelly facing her, and sliced it expertly from the tail to the gills. Lila watched her put her thumb into its mouth, just over the lower jaw, push it in, and, in one downward stroke, remove the gills and the entrails.
The clothes are lovely.
I had no use for them, Mariam muttered.
She dropped the fish on a newspaper, smudged with slimy, gray juice, and sliced off its head.
It was either your daughter or the moths.
Where did you learn to clean a fish like that?
When I was a little girl, I lived by a stream. I used to catch my own fish.
I've never fished.
Not much to it. It's mostly waiting.
Lila watched her cut the gutted trout into thirds. Did you sew the clothes yourself?
Mariam nodded.
When?
Mariam rinsed sections of fish in a bowl of water. When I was pregnant the first time, or maybe the second time, 18, 19 years ago. Long time, anyhow. Like I said, I never had any use for them.
You're really a good chayot. Maybe you can teach me?
Mariam placed the rinsed chunks of trout into a clean bowl. Drops of water dripping from her fingertips, she raised her head and looked at Layla, looked at her as if for the first time. The other night when he... Nobody's ever stood up for me before, she said. Layla examined Mariam's drooping cheeks, the eyelids that sagged in tired folds, the deep lines that framed her mouth. She saw these things as though she too were looking at someone for the first time. And, for the first time, it was not an adversary's face Layla saw, but a face of grievances unspoken, burdens gone unprotested, a destiny submitted to and endured. If she stayed, would this be her own face, Layla wondered, 20 years from now?
I couldn't let him, Layla said. I wasn't raised in a household where people did things like that.
This is your household now. You ought to get used to it.
Not to that. I won't.
He'll turn on you too, you know, Mariam said, wiping her hand dry with a rag. Soon enough. And you gave him a daughter. So you see, your sin is even less forgivable than mine.
Layla rose to her feet.
I know it's chilly outside, but what do you say we sinners have us a cup of chai in the yard?
Mariam looked surprised.
I can't. I still have to cut and wash the beans.
I'll help you do it in the morning.
And I have to clean up here.
We'll do it together. If I'm not mistaken, there's some halwa left over. Awfully good with chai.
Mariam put the rag on the counter. Layla sensed anxiety in the way she tugged at her sleeves, adjusted her hijab, pushed back a curl of hair.
The Chinese say it's better to be deprived of food for 3 days than tea for one.
Mariam gave a half smile. It's a good saying.
It is.
But I can't stay long.
One cup.
They sat on folding chairs outside and ate halwa with their fingers from a common bowl. They had a second cup, and when Layla asked her if she wanted a third, Mariam said she did. As gunfire cracked in the hills, they watched the clouds slide over the moon and the last of the season's fireflies charting bright yellow arcs in the dark. And when Aziza woke up crying and Rashid yelled for Layla to come up and shut her up, a look passed between Layla and Mariam. An unguarded, knowing look. And in this fleeting, wordless exchange with Mariam, Layla knew that they were not enemies any longer. Mariam. From that night on, Mariam and Layla did their chores together. They sat in the kitchen and rolled dough, chopped green onions, minced garlic, offered bits of cucumber to Aziza, who banged spoons nearby and played with carrots. In the yard, Aziza lay in a wicker bassinet, dressed in layers of clothing, a winter muffler wrapped snugly around her neck. Mariam and Layla kept a watchful eye on her as they did the wash, Mariam's knuckles bumping Layla's as they scrubbed shirts and trousers and diapers. Mariam slowly grew accustomed to this tentative but pleasant companionship. She was eager for the 3 cups of chai she and Layla would share in the yard, a nightly ritual now. In the mornings, Mariam found herself looking forward to the sound of Layla's cracked slippers slapping the steps as she came down for breakfast, and to the tinkle of Aziza's shrill laugh, to the sight of her 8 little teeth, the milky scent of her skin. If Layla and Aziza slept in, Mariam became anxious waiting. She washed dishes that didn't need washing. She rearranged cushions in the living room. She dusted clean windowsills. She kept herself occupied until Layla entered the kitchen, Aziza hoisted on her hip.
When Aziza first spotted Mariam in the morning, her eyes always sprang open, and she began mewling and squirming in her mother's grip. She thrust her arms toward Mariam, demanding to be held, her tiny hands opening and closing urgently, on her face a look of both adoration and quivering anxiety.
"What a scene you're making!"
Layla would say, releasing her to crawl toward Mariam.
"What a scene! Calm down! Khala Mariam isn't going anywhere. There she is, your aunt. See? Go on now."
As soon as she was in Mariam's arms, Aziza's thumb shot into her mouth and she buried her face in Mariam's neck. Mariam bounced her stiffly, a half-bewildered, half-grateful smile on her lips. Mariam had never before been wanted like this. Love had never been declared to her so guilelessly, so unreservedly. Aziza made Mariam want to weep. "Why have you pinned your little heart to an old, ugly hag like me?" Mariam would murmur into Aziza's hair. "Huh? I am nobody. Don't you see? A deity. What have I got to give you?" But Aziza only muttered contentedly and dug her face in deeper. And when she did that, Mariam swooned. Her eyes watered, her heart took flight. And she marveled at how, after all these years of rattling loose, she had found in this little creature the first true connection in her life of false, failed connections. Early the following year, in January 1994, Dostum did switch sides. He joined Golbuddin Hekmatyar and took up position near Bala Azar, the old citadel walls that loomed over the city from the Koesher Darwaza mountains. Together, they fired on Massoud and Rabbani forces at the Ministry of Defense and the presidential palace. From either side of the Kabul River, they released rounds of artillery at each other. The streets became littered with bodies, glass, and crumpled chunks of metal. There was looting, murder, and increasingly, rape, which was used to intimidate civilians and reward militiamen. Mariam heard of women who were killing themselves out of fear of being raped, of men who, in the name of honor, would kill their wives or daughters if they'd been raped by the militia. Aziza shrieked at the thumping of mortars. To distract her, Mariam arranged grains of rice on the floor, in the shape of a house or a rooster or a star, and let Aziza scatter them. She drew elephants for Aziza, the way Jalil had shown her, in one stroke, without ever lifting the tip of the pen. Rashid said civilians were getting killed daily, by the dozens. Hospitals and stores holding medical supplies were getting shelled. Vehicles carrying emergency food supplies were being barred from entering the city, he said, raided, shot at. Mariam wondered if there was fighting like this in Herat, too, and, if so, how Mullah Faizullah was coping, if he was still alive, and Bibi Jo, too, with all her sons, brides, and grandchildren. And, of course, Jalil. Was he hiding out, Mariam wondered, as she was? Or had he taken his wives and children and fled the country? She hoped Jalil was somewhere safe, that he'd managed to get away from all this killing. For a week, the fighting forced even Rashid to stay home. He locked the door to the yard, set booby traps, locked the front door too, and barricaded it with a couch. He paced the house, smoking, peering out the window, cleaning his gun, loading and loading it again. Twice, he fired his weapon into the street, claiming he'd seen someone trying to climb the wall. "They're forcing young boys to join," he said. "The Mujahideen are. In plain daylight, at gunpoint, they drag boys right off the streets. And when soldiers from the rival militia capture these boys, they torture them. I heard they electrocute them. It's what I heard. That they crush their balls with pliers. They make the boys lead them to their homes. Then they break in, kill their fathers, rape their sisters and mothers." He waved his gun over his head. "Let's see them try to break into my house. I'll crush their balls. I'll blow their heads off. Do you know how lucky you are to have a man who's not afraid of Shaitan himself?" He looked down at the ground, noticed Aziza at his feet. "Get off my heels," he snapped. making a shooing motion with his gun. Stop following me. And you can stop twirling your wrists like that. I'm not picking you up.